Yeah, well, we will get going, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. There are still people joining in, but we will get going. Firstly, my name is Jim Green, and I'm a member of FOA Adelaide, and I'm the National Anti-Nuclear Campaigner with Friends of the Earth Australia. And I would like to acknowledge, on behalf of those of us in Adelaide, the Kaurna traditional owners. And I would invite other people to acknowledge country in the chat. We'd also love to know who you are and where you're zooming in from. And it would also help us for future events if you could let us know how you heard of this talk. And tonight's meeting is part of the Adelaide Climate Action Week, and I would encourage people to get involved in other activities happening across the week. All of the PowerPoints tonight you can find online, so there's no need to be scribbling down notes. You can just download all these talks online. I know we've got three of our four speakers. We're still missing one, but I don't think that will take long. And we certainly have our first speaker, and I'm really pleased that Paul can join us tonight. Paul's zooming in from continental Europe, and so far the internet connection has been just great. So if everyone could please cross their fingers. Paul is the chair of the Nuclear Consulting Group, which is a great site to check out online. He's a member of the Irish Government's Radiation Protection Advisory Committee, and he's involved with the Bennett Institute for Innovation and Acceleration at the University of Sussex. And welcome, Paul. And I'm just going to bring up your PowerPoint, hopefully.
Good luck. Why aren't they coming up?
Yeah, sorry about that. There's something else going on there. I think I'll be able to get it in a moment, so we won't panic just yet.
That's it.
That's it. That's not coming across great on my screen, but is it okay for others?
It's fine. And also, if you go to slideshow and run the show itself, because I can see the slides on the left. But if like this is okay, if it's okay for everyone.
Yeah,
But
perhaps you can get going, Paul, and I'll
sure.
do my best to improve things as we
J
go along.
just click on the slideshow link at the top of the screen. Should do it.
Okay, so I'll start off from
There's also
so
an icon on the bottom right for the slideshow.
yeah.
Yeah,
Okay.
I do apologize, Paul, but if you get going and I'll do
Sure.
my best to.
Okay, no problem. And I'll go next slide, please, when So okay, so speaking to you from continental Europe, in fact, the island of Corsica, where we're on family holiday, and as you know, the rest of France has been subject to very severe climate impact, lots of fires, lots of problems, and lots of problems for nuclear, especially in terms of climate. So a lot of what I'm saying, I think you all know. Also, the references to fact check all of the statements, because I haven't given links to fact check the statements. All of the references, the links to the statements that I'm making today can be found at the bottom of the presentation, and along with a couple of other things that I've written for the Bennett Institute. And the main source for all of this is the Ergewald document, which I wrote a chapter to. So to kind of get going, yeah, nuclear is quite literally on the front line of climate risk and not in a good way. And as you can see, this is a publication from a small post from the Bennett Institute. I'm Bennett Scholar at Bennett Institute. And Bennett is, in fact, an Australian who is funding two significant research institutes, one in Sussex and one in Cambridge. And he's an Aussie. Okay, so next slide, please. So the first problem with nuclear in terms of climate is coastal. We know what's happening with our coasts. We know what's happening with glacial problems, both in extreme north and the extreme south. And we know that with each passing year, our understanding of climate is becoming more persuasive. Now, with more frequent and destructive storms, storm surges and floods, and storm surges are particularly important for coastal nuclear. A storm surge is what did for Fukushima. It's basically under certain atmospheric conditions, the sea basically ups and moves inland. And the increased storm surges are increasing worldwide. And so storm surges, we hope that sea level rise will be stepwise. We don't know, but we hope it'll be stepwise. But the key problem for nuclear are storm surges, basically, and we know that they're increasing. So as all of this becomes the norm, extreme events, become the norm, and existing flood risk mitigation measures become obsolete. So the kinds of things that we have built, or even in fact are building, may no longer work. Now, this puts nuclear on the front line of the climate change and not in a good way. Part of this is because 41% of all global nuclear plants are coastal. And the majority, in fact, all, I think, yes, all were built before climate became an issue, publicly became an issue, or at least an issue in terms of the design and construction of these nuclear power plants. Now, since climate risks that nuclear and other and all other faces due to rising sea levels. Our understanding is increasingly that it won't be linear. It's probably going to jump. It's not necessarily stepwise. What that means is that all nuclear construction, operation, waste management, and decommissioning will become significantly more expensive and more problematic. Next slide, please. Now, some time ago, and the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, which is the key UK mechanical engineer institute, which is actually pro-nuclear, around 2008, incredibly, they published Adapting to the Inevitable, which can be found. Now, IME said that coastal nuclear sites, they actually said this, it's actually written down, will need considerable investment to protect them against rising sea levels and get this. Even relocation or abandonment. Now that is 2008. Next slide, please. Well, here we see this is a Climate Central. And Climate Central, you can go to this link on Climate Central and play around with flood risk maps to 2040 and check on differing forms of nuclear infrastructure and see what will happen in about 10 or so years. This is a it's based on peer-reviewed published research, so it's good, it's good data. Now, in the middle of this, I'm not sure you can see it, but in the middle of this, I don't know why I'm pointing, in the middle of this is Sizewell and the putative Sizewell C. Sizewell B is a large AGR on the coast of the UK. Sizewell C is the nuclear reactor that supposedly will be constructed. Now, this is a flood risk map once a year. This happens at least once a year, flood risk map for Sizewell C. And I'm not sure whether you can see, but basically within the hook of the lower sort of red part of the diagram, that's where the nuclear plant is. So that within by the time Sizewell C is constructed, it will at least once a year be almost entirely surrounded by storm surge flood water at least once a year. So, I mean, all of this brings to mind the paradox, the difference between the nuclear PR that we hear, which is everywhere at the moment. I spend a lot of time on social media, especially LinkedIn, and one sees an enormous financial and energy push for new nuclear. And the problem being, of course, is it doesn't actually fit the facts. Next slide, please. Okay,
Yep, here we go.
yep. Okay, and the next one, number six. Okay, and here in France, things have been really getting hot, and I've been having long discussions in France with people from EDF, Electricité de France, and regulators, and all this kind of thing, who are in fact panicking. We've seen. What happens basically, nuclear power plants are sited by the coast or by inland rivers or large bodies of waters in order to get cooling. Cooling for the reactors, cooling for the spent fuel ponds. Now, normally, the vast majority of that cooling water is re-discharged back to that receiving water. So there's no loss of water necessarily. Now, as the rivers low flow and heat up, this extra heated cooling water cannot be redischarged to the receiving river. The reason is because it will kill the river ecology. So there are clear regulations, there are clear regulations that after a certain temperature, that nuclear power plant, all nuclear power plants inland, cannot redischarge heated cooling water back to the receiving low flow, already heated river because it would kill the river ecology. Now, EDF have said, "Oh yeah, well, we know all of this, and it's absolutely no problem whatsoever." And they've just announced an 8.7 billion fund to try to start to deal with this. And they say that they can build what's known as cooling towers. When you see these large chimneys that emit basically water vapor, that's what a cooling tower is. The key problem with that is, in an increasingly water scarce world, a significant amount of that water taken from rivers will then evaporate via those cooling towers. Now, in an increasingly water scarce world, that evaporation will have a significant impact, and in that sense is not a solution to the problem that EDF are finding themselves. And one can see in real time now EDF, the French nuclear industry, panicking about this as if it's a new problem. And we've spoken about this for many, many, many years. And as wildfires darken the clouds over France's Bordeaux wine industry, we're having huge wildfires up by Bordeaux, just over the Garonne River, which is in fact an estuary at that point, lies Blaye nuclear power plant. So there's no question but that wildfires will be a significant risk to inland nuclear power plant. As episodic flooding alternates with low river flow and increased water temperature, it has profound adverse effects on reactor cooling and discharge. So, as of now, France EDF reactors shut down at Galtech. And this is not just one reactor, this is a series of reactors at each of these sites: Galtech, Bugey, Chooz plants on the banks of the Garonne, the Rhône, the Meuse rivers, and also the Loire. The Great Loire is drying up as well, too. The River Danube is low flow. It's shut down 1 gigawatt of nuclear in Romania and Hungary, with record low water levels affecting cooling. Next slide, please. Okay. In the US, the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission says that the majority of US nuclear sites already experience flooding hazards beyond their design base. And the US Army War College, and again, all of these references are in the Urgewald report, on which I wrote a chapter about nuclear and climate. So you can fact check all of this. The US Army War College says that nuclear power facilities are at high risk of temporary or permanent closure due to climate threats, with 60% of US nuclear capacity now vulnerable to sea level rise, severe storms, and cooling water shortages. 61% US nuclear energy facilities are expected to face water stress by 2030, 4 years from now, potentially forcing them to reduce generation or shut down. Next slide, please. And then, you know, one of the issues that people discuss about nuclear and why it's not going to help is partially due to cost. It's cost is money is a resource. It's not simply cash. And our resources are becoming limited. Nuclear build, new build, has a doubling cost overrun. Lazard, the well-respected energy research institute, says the levelized cost of energy, ELCO, and ELCO is a form of understanding costs for new nuclear, is about £109 per megawatt hour, making it the most expensive energy source. And I have to emphasize unsubsidized solar and wind, again, emphasized with energy storage for grid balancing. So that's both unsubsidized with storage is 4 times cheaper. Next slide, please. I mean, cost is important, but time is key, and time is running out. It's the most critical variable. So how does that impact and in terms of climate, and how does that impact nuclear? Well, the UK government global data analysis says that including planning and approval, one new nuclear station takes 17 years plus. And we've seen a nuclear power plant in the US, in France, in Finland. We're not sure about China so much because the Chinese data is always problematic. So you're talking about 17 years. New nuclear in Europe is hugely behind schedule and vastly over budget. SMRs, the Great White Hope, still in development and decades away from any commercial deployment. And there are huge discussions about the relative utility of SMRs in terms of their cost per megawatt hour. They produce similar and sometimes more problematic waste per kilowatt hour, and they have both proliferation, safety, and security issues that we'll talk in another way. Now, the former chair of the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, this is the regulator, the US regulators, has published and said that there's not enough time, the former chair, not the present, not Trump's guy, not enough time for nuclear innovation to make a realistic impact on the climate crisis. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, AR6 summary report, and again, there's a link to this graph. The graph doesn't state it, but you can see via the graph, and there's a link to that within the Åkerwald, my chapter in the Åkerwald report. Renewables are now 10 times more effective at cutting carbon dioxide, CO2 emissions than new nuclear. 10 times more effective. Next slide, please. So, wind and solar now dominate global electricity generation. 2025, wind and solar overtook EU fossil fuel power generation. Norway has just said no to nuclear. NATO now backs renewables as a solution to energy security. And again, there's a reference to that. NATO backs renewables as a solution to energy security. UK Chatham House, the government think tank, sort of well, it's independent, but it's a governmental think tank, states that renewables hold the key to energy security in the EU, in the European Union. Now, solar grew by more than 20% in a single year, proving that clean power can scale faster than other technologies. And that's really the key to it. That's both the key to solar, to wind, and the rest of it. So the challenge, and this is very important, the challenge is not generation. In other words, solar, wind, nuclear, whatever. I mean, but it's more about how quickly grids, batteries, and flexibility can be deployed. And there's something very important to note here, which is not in this discussion, this notion of the primary energy fallacy. Now, we know that electricity is generally about 20% of total energy, and so we have to replace that 80% to go to start, making things work. Now, what's interesting about that 80% is that's created via thermal, whether that's oil or gas or nuclear. And of that, two-thirds of that power is lost through heat and through other forms. So two-thirds of that 80% is lost, doesn't count. So in fact, we have to replace that one third of primary energy via electricity. And that is critically important when people start discussing the distinction between electricity and electricity, which is power, and total energy. Next slide, please. Storage. The UK Royal Society, renewables plus long duration storage is cheaper than any system that includes nuclear. Solar has delivered the fastest energy transition in history, and that's set to be beaten by battery storage, with current cumulative global installed capacity of about 690 gigawatt hours and rising. Battery energy storage to grow sixfold worldwide by the end of decade. And in Australia, home battery rebates are adding 2,000 systems per day as the total hurdles towards 500,000 installations. Now, in terms of after the doom and gloom of it all, the renewable evolution, unlike the nuclear renaissance, the renewable evolution is here and now. It's on schedule and cost effective. And we can mitigate climate impact and sustain reliable power systems by expanding renewable energy in all sectors, rapid growth and modernization of the electricity grid, storage technology rollout, faster interconnection, and using power more effectively and efficiently via rational energy management. The lowest hanging fruit is energy efficiency. Now we're coming to towards the end now. The next slide, please. So all key international and national energy organizations, institutes agree that renewables will do the heavy lifting for the energy transition. The future backbone of the global energy supply system will be renewable, sustainable, and cost-effective. That's not it's not disputed, it's just a fact. Nuclear is already, no matter about, in the future, nuclear is already too late and too costly to play any positive role in tackling the climate and energy crisis. So at a time when so much looks grim, the renewable evolution offers real hope. In 2025, more power was generated worldwide from renewables than from coal. 91% of new renewables are now cheaper than fossil fuels. The UN confirms renewables increase their lead over fossil and fissile fuels via economies of scale, tech innovation, and supply chain rollout. And the killer is each year, nuclear adds only as much net global power capacity as renewables add every 2 days. China is installing wind and solar equivalent of five large nuclear power plants per week. So here are the links to fact check. No, here 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 are some links of some things I've written. And the last slide, please. Okay, that's the main link to fact check, basically all of the stuff that I've been talking about. You can find the references in that report: debt delays, dependencies, why public banks should not support nuclear power. My chapter is New Nuclear, Too Late and Too Costly for the Climate and Energy Crisis. It was published a couple of months ago by Ergovald. Great, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you so much for all that information, Paul, and a reminder to everyone that you can download Paul's PowerPoint from a website, which I'll share with you in a moment and later on. I've got a whole lot of questions, Paul, but if I can just ask one or two before we move on to our next speaker. There are powerful forces driving nuclear power, but on the other hand, it couldn't be all that powerful because renewables now account for over 50% of UK electricity generation. And another factoid that I'm impressed with is that across the 27 countries of the European Union, only one is building a nuclear power reactor. I think that might be Slovakia. So I'm just wondering, do you feel like nuclear is just pushing a rear guard campaign to revive itself, or do you feel like it still has real strength? And if it does have real strength, is that connected to its contribution to the military programs in the UK and France?
Certainly, if you look at the military civil complex, it's clearly involved. I mean, there's no question about it. And if you look at Andy Stirling and Phil Johnson's work, they lay that out pretty clearly. But it would actually be cheaper and more effective. And it's true that there are synergies, but it would be actually cheaper if one wanted, if they wanted to keep nuclear military, it would be cheaper to maintain nuclear military and let civil nuclear power go. Basically, what's happening is that the cost of nuclear military is coming down because of that synergy, because of joint research, joint intellectual capacity, and the rest of it. But you can actually divide the two, and it would still be cheaper. As to nuclear's rear guard, I guess because of the thrust of the renewable evolution, nuclear knows it's its last chance now. This 20th century failing technology, it's a last chance, and so it's a huge push by a vast industrial and military lobby to embed systems, research, funding, political power. To get all of these ducks in a line and to convince people. So there's this huge PR push that this is the way forward, that basically nuclear w will somehow ma magically save us from climate. And it's this sort of technological way of thinking that seems to be appallingly stupid, basically. So that despite all of the facts, this current nuclear renaissance, and there have been a number of failed nuclear renaissance, is sort of pottering along. But I guess it's the cost aspect that will do for it, perhaps more than anything else, really. It's just so mind-bogglingly expensive, and it just in a practical terms, I think really it's the cost that'll do for it. And of course, the issue about climate, which is now becoming a key issue.
And just one final question, Paul. The new British Prime Minister, can we expect any change?
Unlikely. Andy Burnham, good guy. Andy Burnham has in the past supported nuclear. The new energy secretary used to be head of the new NEF, New Energy Foundation, and NEF have always been counter-nuclear, and she was head of NEF. But the unions, the sort of the zombie dinosaur unions, are very pro-nuclear. They don't realize that there are infinitely more jobs in renewables than nuclear, and they have push in the Labour Party. So it's probably likely that Burnham will sort of keep on, at least publicly talking about and keep on with nuclear, but there will be a sort of background tow, both for him and the Energy Secretary, to calm things down.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. I've got 100 other questions, but we will move on. But I really appreciate your work, and I've just put the link in the chat where people can download your PowerPoint. And once
Excellent.
again, I would encourage people to check out the Nuclear Consulting Group website. Paul, can you just let us know what the URL is for Nuclear Consulting Group? Because I understand there might be a couple of fake versions out there as well.
Yeah, there are. I mean, just plow through them. Just go plow through them and Google nuclearconsultinggroup.org or something. I can't remember the URL straight away. There are a few fake URLs that have really tried to take it over. You kind of finally get to Nuclear Consulting Group if you sort of get through the trash.
I think it might be nuclearconsulting.org. Does that sound right?
That sounds right. But beware, there's a couple of other sort of industry nuclear consult
Yeah.
sites. But you can see
Anyway.
straight away. You can see straight away.